Accession number 10934, rule 5.
General Roll, rule 5.
Okay, those days we didn't know that Udet committed suicide, and he got a very big funeral, and the old father pilots were called to attend this ceremony, and Mölders flew back, and he crashed in Breslau Schöngarten and got killed in a Heinkel 111. He was not flying, he was a passenger in this plane, and there was a rumor also that he got killed. He was wrong. It was a normal flying, unfortunately, a very tragic accident. The airplane hit the chimney in the fog, in the final approach to Breslau Schöngarten. There was one witness survived, and he could tell the whole story. So we lost Mölders, which was a big loss. Galland succeeded him then as a fighter general for the fighters. Okay. When we moved to the east, to Taganrog, Rostov, and I told you these problems with these extreme temperatures and with this really adverse weather, snow, and we couldn't get in the ground. We had our headquarters or whatever you call it, our command stand, to explode it into the ground. It was frozen, And the Russians were used to this, and they came very early in the morning because they had an auxiliary engine. They put it under a rod of the engine and started by this auxiliary engine the main engine. You didn't have this. In those days, the 109 had what we call an eclipse starting system, where the mechanic has to turn a handle and to up to a certain rounds, and then you engage in the cockpit the engine. And it didn't work in those temperatures,
Like they used to have on the old motor cars.
Right, something like that. And we learned our lesson later on. We managed this by pumping some fuel into the oil lines. So when we came back from the last mission of the day, we kept the engine running for 3 minutes, opened the valve, and given access to the fuel into the pump lines, in the oil lines. So the oil became thin, and you could start it much better the next morning. That's what we did, and later on we got some cloth over the engine and some heating oven underneath. So we, but at the beginning, we were hit and surprised. We had some problems.
Is it true that a Soviet prisoner gave you some advice about how to deal with the cold?
No. This was a. Okay. We had to find something to get the cold. So, by the way, we didn't have Soviet prisoners and we never get in contact. We had some. Soviets who moved with us.
Who defected?
Yeah, no, there was a defection, they lived in their country. And they were on the German side because the country was occupied by the Germans. And they moved with us and did some service for us, they in the kitchen and things like that, very nice and very good contact with them, Very nice, and they loved it. They loved to stick with us.
Did you get Soviet pilots who defected to your
airport? No. We got a Soviet pilot who we shut down, right, and we captured him. This is my only experience with a Soviet pilot. He was a major, a very tough guy. We shut him down, down in the Caucasus, and he had to bail out. And he bailed out and dropped into a sunflower field. And he was shooting around with his pistol, very, very, very fanatic. But there was no chance. If you surrounded that field, and you don't come out, it's over. And we got him. And at that time, I had a fan. This was my headquarters, my command stand. I had NCOs, an NCO who was born in Charkov. He spoke fluently Russian. And he brought this guy to me. It was a major, very good head, very good, very intelligent looking. And I offered him a cigarette. He said no. In those days, it was very hot. This was in summer and fall, 42 down in the Caucasus, in Gonchakovka. And then we had, in the canisters, we had tea, you know, with some lemon in, always, because it was very hot, and high temperatures, and just for drinking. And I offered him, would you like to have a cup of tea? No. And then when I asked him and interrogated him in a very friendly manner, and I drank my tea, then he accepted the tea. I think he proved that the tree was not poisoned. You know, they were very suspicious, very suspicious. And he was treated as, always as a fighting man, at a fighting unit, and was treated well. The trouble starts when you come back, you know. And then he was taken back, and I don't know where he was. I got the rumor that he escaped. And very clever, he was taken by 252 back to higher headquarters, together with wounded soldiers, you know, was with all these heads, and it was a mess. This, and he was in, and maybe he has camouflaged himself and walked out with them, disappeared. Okay, coming back, we are in Rostov, Taganov, and the 28th November, 51. There was slowly the moves. There was frozen front lines. You know, the winter had started. There was no operation anymore, and we had frozen front lines. And we flew over Russian territory one day, 28th November, and I had only a two ship formation, the fighter sweep, and we ran into Russians, and there was a dogfight. And I got a Russian, and he got flames. He got out in flames, and I was blinded by this way. It was late at afternoon, you know. We had, still sticking with German time, it turned dark about 2:30, 3 o'clock. It was completely dark. And anyway, I was out about 2 o'clock or 1:30, turned dark already. And I was blinded by this fire. And in this very moment, a Russian fighter came underneath me and behind me, and he shot me. And he shot off my engine, you know, the engine quit, and I said, guys, to the German lines, you know. This was over Russian territory. So I turned immediately to the German lines. There was not a solid line, there was tank spearheads. And I called my wingmaster, and I got shot, the engine is out. I have to belly land somewhere here. And it was half frozen surface. It was desert, you know, there was no tree, no nothing. And so I was heading and to land somewhere in the open, and I saw a little Balka, which is a little canyon just across me in my landing direction. And I forgot, I said, I cannot crash into this Balka, to this canyon. And I tried to get down my airplane before I reached that gate. But I had a too high speed then, you know, and I touched the ground and jumped off again. I touched the ground with the belly, no wheels certainly, and hit the ground with the belly and with my propeller. And it cut the ground and looked like bananas then and stopped completely. And they was hanging over this canyon. And then I had not to stall out, I had to pull forward, get up speed, and then I stalled into this canyon. The last thing I saw was a wall coming to me, and that's out. And to make the long story short, my big man circled, and he knew exactly, and he saw the whole mess. My aircraft completely dismantled, the wings came off, the engine was thrown away, and nearby tanks saw that crash, and they came and they cut me out of the cockpit. Because I was unconscious, I hit my head and with a lever, which was supposed to get rid of the canopy. And there was a lever, and I hit the lever with my head and scalped me almost. Okay, and I was taken to a truck driving to the back of the tank Autobahn, and I was unconscious, and finally I came to consciousness much later, and I had awful pains. And what happened, I had broken my back 3 times, which was not recognized that time, because the Germans were on a back move, and there was no X-ray station, nothing around. They took me to Taganrog, and in a burned-out school in the cellar, I was operated. and the next day, I was taken back to Mariupol, Chersonese, and finally, after 2 weeks, I ended up in Bucharest, in a hospital. This was the first station where they had an X-ray. And they X-rayed me and said, poor boy, forget flying. 3 times. I was paralyzed, the right side, and I couldn't move and nothing. And then, okay, it took me quite a time from there. I got a full body cast, an extension cast, and after a while I was taken in a Red Cross train and taken back to Vienna, where I arrived in January 1942, and taken to a hospital and to a specialist. And the next morning my station doctor came and took what came in tonight, you know, took me one week to go through with the strain to the capacity minus. We arrived at midnight in Vienna, taken to the hospital. And the next morning the station doctor came, and this station doctor became my wife.
So really you had been advised that you would never fly again.
Yes.
What made you decide that you were determined to go back? Why did you do it?
I wanted to fly. I wanted to be in this great experience and adventure. And I was a fighter pilot, and I was trained for a fighter pilot. I was educated. I had a lot of friends in my squadron. This was my family, you know. I want to live under the same fate as they did, you know. I don't want to make an exclusion. I will tell you, in the hospital, some doctor came and said, what was I at that time? Maybe a captain or whatever it was, and said, look, you have to go to the front line again. We write you and so on and so on. No, no. I go to my comrades. So I wanted to. I didn't like the war. The longer the war was and the more we lost, we were fed up with the whole thing. But I could not exclude myself. I was under the same fate. Yeah.
So it was a sense of duty to your comrades?
Comrades and, yes. I don't know how to
the country.
Define it, you know. Also to the country. We were in a war. You cannot play in golf if otherwise is in a war. You know, that's no amusement besides this. This is nonsense.
Could I ask you, you said that you were fed up of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Even by then, we're talking about the early part of 1942. Did you think that then that Germany might be defeated?
Not that time. Not that time. You know, we, knowing now, I'm talking about my attitude at that time, not what I know now. I mean, the war was lost, if you wish, as we started the war. And but there were chances to win the war, there's no doubt. And Hitler made horrible mistakes, you know. And, okay, and but he had chances. You know, we were successful in the West. The British Islands, we couldn't conquer. We didn't ever get the air superiority. We lost the Battle of Britain, in other words. With tremendous losses of pilots, you know. We never recovered from these losses. You got time. The Royal Air Force got time to build up the force again. We were engaged in so many front lines. We never could get up again. You know, we were in North Africa, we were in the North Cape, we were in Russia, we were in Italy, we were everywhere. And this is, we ran out of pilots. we ran out of fighter pilots. And but you know, the British Islands certainly was a tremendous obstacle for the support of Germany. You know, we ran out of goods. You know, this the access to Germany was blocked, and as soon as we lost the submarine war, you know, by radar and sonar, what the hell is this was a catastrophe, you know. Out of 50 submarines, 48 never returned from one day to the other. So this was a big mistake, a big problem. We in the east, where Hitler was forced to gain metal, nickel, oil, how do you do,
the main materials.
Raw materials. He lost all these areas, you know. We were on a retreat. So when did I recognize that the war is lost? You know, there was always a hope to come to an agreement, maybe with Stalin, over the West, and say, okay, now let's talk. But it was deeply rooted in Hitler's personality. He would never talk. He'd do the dead end and destroy Germany. That's what he said. If this people is not capable to win the war, then it's worth that it will be destroyed. I mean, this is a an attitude of a fanatic psychiatric psychopath, no doubt. But I thought the war is over when they broke through the invasion, you know, when in 44, it might before that you had a hope, maybe we come to an arrangement. And everybody was talking about the secret weapons and what the hell that is, you know. And we didn't know that, maybe. But it was, you know, there's a small hope, but okay, maybe we come out with a with one off knocked eye, but anyhow. But when the breakthrough in Avranches,
So if we can get back to your personal story now.
Yeah.
You were talking about recuperating.
Yeah.
What, did you fully recover from your broken
back? No, never. Not till now. You know, I have certainly have many problems. I had to learn to walk like a child. I was my right leg was paralyzed, and I got a lot of electrical support, you know, where to move, to get the muscles again working, and not all muscles came back. Okay, not all functions came back, but I, you know, I was a very sportive man, and I did all my exercises till now, till today, and this helped, you know, compensating with other muscles. I don't want to dramatize the whole thing. I went back to, let's say, to normal operations. And when I went back to the front, in those days, we didn't have this, what we would call today a flight surgeon, yeah, who really checks you according to your flying functions and flying missions. I was in a hospital, there was a tremendous professor, neurologist. But he knew anything about flying G-forces and things like that. We had a tremendous impact on your body. And when I was in a hospital, one of my previous commanders, an old man, he was pulled out of the front line. He was World War One participant already. And so he was one of these old gentlemen, you know. He ran a flying school, a fighter school, near Vienna. And he learned that I was in the hospital. He visited me. And I said, well, Colonel, or whatever it was, I want to practice. Can I fly in with you? He said, sure, come out, and I give you an airplane. I said, what? And, you know, the biplane, the Bücker Jungmeister. This was an acrobatic airplane, and I wanted to check myself whether I'm able or not. So one day, I said, okay, let's get out. You could get out by my tramway. And I, my professor said to my wife, this the captain, he wants to fly. Please get out. Go out with him and look how it works out. And my later wife came with me, escorting me. And I took a chair and set him in front of a hangar. I was very proud in the airplane. And Bigger Young Meister, I made my loops and rolls and everything. Beautiful. Came down, you know, red face by the, all these. And I said, I can write. It goes very well. 1 week later, I took my ticket and back to the front line, to Russia, Rostov. And arrived in the Rostov area shortly before we started the big attack, or basal attack down to the Caucasus.
So this is summer, 1942.
Summer 42. August, late August 42. you know, you come to your unit and you see what the changes, young pilots, and which pilots get killed and missed and so on and so on. Get familiar, and then I come out and say, okay, you take the airplane, and a friend of mine said, I will introduce you in the front line. I'll show you where we are and the whole thing.
When you got back to your unit, yeah. Had there been many changes in atmosphere?
And no, not atmosphere, but in persons. You know, some got killed, some were missed, some new pilots came. But the same, you know, the squadron commander was still the same, and group commander was still the same. So this was the same atmosphere, and there was no change. No.
And but of course, you were operating now in summer instead of winter.
Sure, yeah, big difference. Yeah, living in tents, and you know, you have your fires, like Boy Scouts, you know, flying Boy Scouts. And
so
then
it must have been much pleasanter conditions.
Much better, you know, but even more fighting, certainly, you know. And so I had to go to my airplane and jumped in. I couldn't jump in. They helped me, the mechanics, lifted me in. And what I had, I suffered from, this muscle here completely was, how do you call it, was gone. So I was sitting
muscle in your behind.
I was sitting, the gluteus maximus was shrank. And it was not fitted anymore, so it's out. And I got a bladder. And I was sitting on that bladder, you know, this way. Because I couldn't sit this for hours, it was impossible. So I did on the upper leg, you know, on this bladder.
Eye.
On this bladder. And I got a special arrangement, you know, and they always could spot me in the air because I was sitting way forward in the cockpit. If you see the silhouette, you fly formation, that's he, because I was very close to the visor. The visor's here, you know, and I was very forward positioned in the cockpit. Okay, and then I flew. Well, we made some rough turns, and I think my back is broken, you know. I overcame this and got adjusted to it and get acquainted with it. But I recognized that the G-forces in the 109 are completely different to the G-forces in the Bigger Jungmeister, you know. And I had to take this in account and be careful. Anyhow, I started, and I was very eager, you know. Very, I lost a lot of weight. When I came back, I had lost a lot of weight. And so I was, and was 9 months in hospital, I was very eager to fly. It's like a horse you take out in spring, you know, was over the winter stable. You can't control that horse, you know. It was about a similar situation. Okay, and down to the Caucasus. It was again a fast-moving operation, which ended up at the foot of the Caucasus down in Solatskaya in late in fall or winter, when winter started. And I shut down a lot of airplanes, these operations, you know, quite a number. I get my iron course and I get iron course with oak leaves.
This was when you shut down your first Spitfire, was it?
Yes. No, when I came back. This was, wait a minute. No, this was 43 in summer 43 when we went down to the Cuban bridgehead And all these attacks, Krimskaya, these big Cheng attacks, there was one attack, two attacks, number 13, the Russians made tremendous attacks. And there it was protected, Spitfires, and there I got my first Spitfire. This was 9 months earlier. Okay, and those were Russian planes, and but also already Boston bombers and things like that. Okay, and then at the foot of the mountains, I went back to Germany. I got married before Christmas. I had to go back before Christmas to my unit. Can you imagine, as a young married pilot, a squadron commander, from Vienna all the way back to the Caucasus. It's way out, 2,000 kilometers or how. And I arrived there, and it was steep winter and cold. And a couple of days later, I got the order to go with my wing to Gigant to support Stalingrad. And this was very difficult, I think.
Gigant was the name of a collective farm, was it?
Yeah, just nothing else. Three buildings in the nowhere, yeah? From horizon to horizon, snow, no tree, no nothing, just these three buildings made out of mud.
And thatch.
Ah. And there we flew to Stalingrad, and this was a lousy operation, you know, and there were a lot of counterattacks and Russian troops and so on. And we worked off our airplanes, and in Gigant I got the order to give my operational airplanes, which were not very many, to another group and go back with these, with the only ones which have to be going in inspection for repair and so on and so on. And the whole group was taken back to Nikolaev, where we were equipped with 42 new aircraft. Nikolaev, way back in the Ukraine. And there we got 42. I sent my pilots back to Wiener Neustadt, and they picked up new airplanes, came, and then we from there we went down to the Krim Peninsula. Yeah, Kerch, Kuban. And this was a new. Just in, this was after Stalingrad, this was in January, February, March. We went down to Kerch, Krim Peninsula, Kerch, and Kuban, Pritchett. And there, heavy fighting started for months. And, you know, Novorossiysk, these tremendous attacks and fighting, and here...